You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
It's time for your view from the C-suite here on Classic Business, bringing you closer to the country's business leaders, what makes them tick, what keeps them up at night and keeps them going in such a brutally tough environment. Well, my next guest has extensive experience in the financial services sector, having held executive positions at Alex Forbes and Old Mutual. During his eight-year tenure at Forbes, he was MD of Investment Solutions and joined head of the institutional businesses. For over a decade, he held various executive positions at Old Mutual Group. He's a fellow of the Africa Leadership Initiative South Africa and a member of the Aspen Global Leadership Network, someone who's passionate about education and jazz. And he's also a long-suffering Arsenal supporter and a Pirates supporter, I might add. Derek Mcebe, Chief Executive of Stanlib, welcome to The View.
Thank you, Michael. I look forward to the conversation this evening.
I promise not too many Arsenal jokes, but I do see that betting on them has almost sunk Paddy Power in the UK. Now,
just well, at least Pirates are winning.
At least.
I'm 50% there. Arsenal will finally come right again.
You've hedged your bets. Just take me back a little bit, Derek. Tell me a little bit more about your early life and how that formulated your worldview and your career path into financial services.
Yeah, well, I studied business science at the University of Cape Town. And at quite an early stage, I became very much interested in finance. Although I majored in accounting, I sort of like had a feeling that the CA profession, of which I'm a member on, was a route to something. I didn't know what that would be, but I certainly didn't see myself as being a partner at an accounting firm and being that for the rest of my life. And so I went and did my articles at KPMG, and towards the end of my article there, I applied to join Old Mutual. And Old Mutual, when I joined in 1996, had an excellent reputation of building investment talent. It was a university of asset management in South Africa. And I went there with a sole purpose of really building an investment career. But I probably had a shorter-term view, which was in 3 or 4 years' time, I'd go and look for something else. But being a large company and the opportunity that they presented to me, it enabled me to do a lot more. And what I envisaged as probably a 3-4 year journey ended up being close to a 12-year journey, which then led me to going to lead Alexander Forbes. So after a while, I really got fascinated by investments. And I'll probably say that in the last 7 or 8 years, I've come to accept and to appreciate the good work that the investment industry actually does to enable people to achieve a whole lot of objectives. So it's become a bit more than just a job. It's become more of a calling. I wouldn't go as far as what Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs described his job, which is that he was doing God's work. But I certainly believe that there's a very important purpose that we fulfill as investment managers. And that excites me. And that's what wakes me up in there at night in terms of my interest in investment. So it has evolved. It probably started as an interest in just managing money and the thrill of being exposed to markets. As you move up the organization, you start running organization, you realize that you've got an impact on people, and not only your own staff, but the millions of savers that entrust money to you, and that they see you as a very important part of them realizing their dreams.
And obviously, within that, Derek, over the last few years, it has been a difficult time for investors in the South African market in particular.
Yeah.
We've seen our market go sideways. We are at something of an inflection point, one feels. And I want to now fast forward to where we find ourselves today. The Democrats over in the US have a triple sweep. They've got the presidency, they've got the Senate, and they've got the Congress. We have a president-elect in Joe Biden who's very keen to spend America's way out of this COVID crisis. It has a lot of investors worried. 10 years is a good run at any stage in a market, and that's certainly been the standout for the US over the last 10 years, its outperformance. There's a feeling now that we're going to start swinging into the emerging markets. Is that your sense as well, where you see outperformance or alpha over the next few years?
I've heard stories that maybe the next decade is a decade of emerging markets. I just think that one has to be very selective to have a broad brush a view of that emerging market as a whole. I think there are pockets of emerging markets which are structurally strong, politically strong, have got deep markets, have got great companies, etc., that are going to do well, but not everybody is going to get caught in that way. Just like as we see in developed markets, not all developed markets perform the same way.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there's no doubt that in an environment where investors are willing to take a lot more risk, what they call the risk-off environment, that emerging markets will tend to be in favor. We'll tend to see a lot more money going, and we know that when there are a lot more buyers of a particular index or investment, the prices go up. But emerging markets are quite volatile. It doesn't take long for the mood to change, and to change very, very quickly, simply because of some of the democratic institutions are not as well developed. In some instances, just the overall and the economies of those are geared to commodities or parts of the economy which are have got a tremendous amount of volatility built into them, and so I'm not into this view of actually saying the next decade is an emerging markets decade. I think what I've learned is that we've got to accept that there will be ebbs and flows, there will be cycles, but the best thing you can do is to make sure that you are adequately diversified. That if there is a benefit coming out of emerging markets, you carry some of that. And if there's benefits coming out of developed markets, you carry some of that. And so my view would be a lot more diversified, to try and time when is to go to emerging markets and when is to go into developed markets. Unless you are a professional investor, for a lot of us who have got other things in life to worry about, schooling, jobs, etc., we just don't have the time to be trying to time the market.
And on that point, you say that managing people's money is more than just a job. It's a calling. It's ensuring that people can retire, that can bequeath something to their heirs one day, to build wealth, to build family wealth, to be able to send their children to the best schools. These are aspirational things in a country that comes from a history of legislated denial. It is more than just a job. But what is the one thing that you wish somebody had told you when you were starting out, when it comes to investing and starting this journey of building wealth? And perhaps attached to that, do you remember how much your first paycheck was and how you spent it?
Yeah, so I had a rather unusual thing in that when I finished school, I actually worked for a year before I went to university. So I had a bit of an enforced gap year.
So did I.
Yeah, so I wanted to study medicine, and then I changed my mind. And then my mother told me, well, if you change your mind, you must go and find a job while you're waiting for whatever the next career will be. So I remember what my first paycheck was in when I finished high school in 1988. It was 2,400 rand.
Wow.
And all of it, I basically had to, because I was at home, I had to contribute to the running of the household. So the bulk of it went there, and I never saved any of it. I really started saving when I was at university, because I was part of the investors club, and then we would do a few buy shares here and there, etc. So that's how I got exposed to savings. Just going back to your question, what is the one thing that I wish someone had told me? I wish someone had really taught me the power of compounding, which is you start small, But the real value is in compounding. And the maths of compounding is just absolutely phenomenal. If you look at a typical student who starts in first year and they start saving a bit of their allowance, by the time they're in the mid-30s or 40s, if they've done that diligently, and they sort of like 10% of their earnings and invest them regularly, you can build a very nice nest egg. So the power of compounding, and I suppose the thing that helped me was that my mother always had this view, which was that you should always keep 10% of your money for the rainy day. And so from every stage, whatever I earned, I tried to save 10% of that. And I've kept that over the years. And so that has enabled me to have a decent nest egg.
That's certainly a great bit of advice and something that I'm trying to impress upon my very young children. It must be said, they're a little bit too young to be talking about finance, but as soon as they understand it, the power of compounding, the rule of 72, all that stuff that we didn't really talk about around the dinner table. We came from a very, I think, typical South African family in the sense that it was very conservative. We didn't really discuss money, and it just kind of was a taboo. It wasn't done. At least now in today's South Africa, I think we're a lot more open about those conversations. Now, Derek, I just want to move on to the period we find ourselves in at the moment. And obviously a very bizarre, unique, strange, unprecedented, whatever the word you want to describe it is. It's a period that none of us have seen in our careers before. What has been the biggest impact that COVID-19 and the lockdown and working from home and all of that has had on Stanlib?
Yeah, look, I mean, we are very fortunate in that, unlike other businesses, the whole of the financial sector was treated as an essential industry. So we had to be open, and we had to make sure that we're able to serve our clients and our advisors, at the same time making sure that our people were safe. And so the biggest impact for us has been, one, in terms of operating remotely. I would say the extent of our human connection maybe is not as strong as what you would like it to be. I'm a firm believer that there is a great deal of social capital that we all build, which makes us better human beings and better professionals. And it's probably not as strong when we're all looking at small screens in front of us trying to connect with each other. But, you know, we've managed. So that's the first thing, which is really the impact on people and the ability to connect and on the corporate culture. I think the second one has been we've seen a meaningful move from our clients to want to transact with us digitally. Obviously, in a lot of instances, we're all forced to do it. But I think the level of adoption and the pace at which our clients have transitioned has been a lot faster than we would have imagined without COVID. The third one has been we all need to really understand what is truly essential in this environment. What really matters to clients? It matters that we deliver to them great investment outcomes, that we deliver a very frictionless way of them either investing or disinvesting from us. And then thirdly, we give them a sense of comfort that our organization is going to be resilient. And those are the three things that really matter to us. And so, you know, when you start saying those are the three things that matter, you get to a point which is, gee, there's a whole lot of stuff that we do which really doesn't make a difference to clients that one should actually be evaluating. And that is one of the lessons, is really what is truly essential in building and running a successful asset manager.
Just to add on to that quickly, the virus and certainly what we've seen around this big theme of ESG investing can actually be traced back to obviously wet markets. There is some speculation, but effectively what we're doing to the planet, if you listen to Bill Gates, is going to lead to a greater frequency of these kinds of zoonotic viruses. That really has a link through to the impact that we have on the planet, and that really is directed via the investment decisions that we make as well. So there is a closed loop here in terms of this entire environment.
Yes, I suppose what we know now is that if we have downplayed the importance of ESG, this particular environment where we're in right now, it's just reminding all of us that the principles of managing money responsibly and taking a long term are absolutely non-negotiable, and it's something that needs to be accelerated. And, you know, the thing that sort of keeps me really awake at night is that we've got this virus, which, to a large extent, unlike most people, I'm reasonably hopeful that we'll find a solution to it. We've got the vaccines, we'll have a change in human behavior that will result in us being able to live and manage this particular virus like we've done with many others, whether it's smallpox or flu or hepatitis, all of those things over the years we've been able to manage those. But when we started talking about the impact of climate, now that's a really big one. And that's the one that, in my view, if you think about the impacts, you refer to some of the comments being made by people like Bill Gates. It's going to be interesting to see what he says in his book, which comes out later on this quarter. I think it's coming out in March, when he talks about climate change. But those are really big issues that we need to tackle. And so we need to double our efforts in actually looking at how we manage money with a view of making sure that we have a planet that is livable and that is sustainable. Otherwise, the climate gets hotter, we have more frequency of floods, et cetera, et cetera. The world becomes unlivable, and I'm not sure that that is the way that we would like custodians of savings not to take those issues into account in making sure that our planet is livable.
It was so interesting. I think it was last year, Rosemary Hunter came out with a legal opinion basically saying that pension fund trustees have an obligation not only to current members but future members as well to ensure that any investment decisions that they take or their asset consultants or their asset managers on behalf of the fund and the trustees has to be mindful of that future that trustees are going to be retiring into. So a very interesting conversation, and obviously with the energy transition front of mind here in South Africa and persistent load shedding, how are we going to ensure that as stewards of capital, that capital backs the right projects for that sustainable future? I just want to move on to a concluding thought, if you will, about where we find ourselves as a country. And I just want to provide a caveat here that I wouldn't want to be the president through a pandemic for all the money that's still left in the Treasury, what little there is still left in the South African Treasury. But if you were President Cyril Ramaphosa right now, what would you change or do tomorrow in the way government's been managing and handling its response to this pandemic, where we seem to be playing whack-a-mole, going in and out of lockdown, and it does look, from my vantage point, like government isn't fully cognizant of the economic damage that is being wrought, not only at a small business level, but through sectors like the alcohol industry and tourism and hospitality. What would you do if you were made president tomorrow?
Well, I don't know if I would I would need to be forced to take up that role, because I think it's a tough and frankly a bit of a thankless position at the moment, based on what he's dealing with, not only in terms of the economy, but just the structure that he has around him in order to be able to execute on his very demanding mandate. My starting point will be, I would work on the basis that South Africa has got a number of plans that it has developed over the years. And so it's not the question of plans, it's the question of the ability to execute and to build an engine that is able to execute. Some people call it a capable state. Certainly, I think you need a government that is got a lot of technocrats who are not wedded to a particular party, but who are just there to do a technical job of making sure that the business of government actually happens. So I think the hiring and the staffing of the key people who need to execute on these plans would be one area which, in my view, requires a great deal of effort. The second one I would look at is when I look at the different players in South Africa and see who is looking a lot more stronger. I look at the household. The household has been battered by this. The level of savings and rainy day funds or whatever are depleted, even if they were there. We know that most families simply don't have rainy day funds. And you can look at the level of debt in the household. It's relatively high. So the household is not in great shape. Government, we all know that they're really stretched in terms of their fiscal capacity. So they're not in great shape. The guys who are really in great shape are the corporates. Since 2008, the corporates learned a lesson that they needed to be very conservative in their balance sheets. They need to have a whole lot of liquidity. And they need to have all of these scenarios around which enable them to navigate a lot of these things. So my thing would be, if I was president, I would actually go to these corporates and say, look, guys, I've got a whole lot of these things I'm trying to manage around the pandemic. Tell me what role you think you can play.
Mm.
I'll give you just a very interesting example that emerged in the last month around the vaccine. To me, the vaccine is a very interesting PPP because quite clearly the state was not going to be able to afford to pay for the vaccine. Now we've roped in medical aid schemes, and which are, to some degree, you can argue, people would argue that, yeah, there's a tax deduction and therefore it's funded by the fiscus or whatever, but it's treated as a private sector initiative. By getting the medical aid schemes involved in using their risk funds, we now have a solution around how many people we can vaccinate. And so there's a lot more of that thinking, in my view, which is actually saying to the guys in the private sector, you are probably best placed at the moment. You've got the resources. Your balance sheet are in much better shape than the rest of the household or the government. How do we actually get you to actually play a lot more prominent role in helping us to sell those things? To me, that would be, I would just call the top executives of the top 100 companies in South Africa and say, ladies and gentlemen, here's a problem. I want you to come back to me and tell me how I should solve this problem. Bring your own resources and let's work together. I can't see him being able to solve the issues that he's grappling with now without a greater involvement of the private sector than what we have seen at the moment. What we're seeing at the moment is we sort of hesitantly bring them in whenever there's a problem. I don't think we are inviting them and saying, guys, just come along. We want you to be in the party. We want you to dance with us. And we want to get your views about how we can implement some of the challenges that we face.
Yeah, and that builds that trust because from where I sit, Derek, that has been the missing ingredient for such a long time. I mean, you can go back to the days of Tony Trayer when he was head of Anglo and sort of stuck his neck above the parapet and then President Thabo Mbeki chopped him off at the knee. Same with Roel Khoza when he was chairman at Nedbank. And so there's been this detente between business and the government, an uneasy truce, and it hasn't been a trusting relationship. Into COVID and the crisis, and then we saw what could happen through the Solidarity Fund and pockets of working together, how much more we can achieve. And still, through the vaccine, I believe we're going to see much more of that in terms of logistics and distribution and using private pharmaceutical chains and their cold storage, and maybe bring in SAB if they can see eye to eye, SAB with government after the alcohol ban. But the short of this long statement is that there is an opportunity in this crisis to recalibrate that relationship, and that should be good for South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, to me, is that we all know that there's a whole lot of skills that are available in that sector. We're just going to figure out a way of how we bring those to be utilized. As we've shown now, we've been able to utilize some of them. And we could have been doing that a lot more aggressively in all other spheres where we feel that is required. So South Africa doesn't really, in my view, lack a plan. We just lack the ability to execute.
Derek Mcebe, Chief Executive Officer of Standard, thank you so much for sharing your view from the C-suite with us here on Classic Business. I wish you a much more prosperous year, an easier year than we had in 2020. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael.